Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio in real time via ZipWhip landline texting at 540-371-5756 or comment on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth from the University of Mary Washington here this morning. We're going to talk, obviously, politics. Dr. Farnsworth, good to have you here this morning.
Glad to be here, Ted.
I see you all over social media, especially these days. These are just about every day and every tweet that comes out of the White House, there's something for you to comment on or talk about.
Well, you know, this has been an amazing year with the, you know, Virginia election that didn't end in terms of the local House of Delegates race, the real challenging issues that the Trump administration is dealing with, very combative environment going into 2018. Yeah, there's a lot of material to work with when you study political science.
This has really been some year. We'll start off. We're going to talk a little national politics, a little state politics, and then we'll talk about a book that you have coming out. But first year of the Trump administration, not really the first year that they wanted to have. Just in that you'd think that a new president comes in, and the first year is usually their year where they have the most political capital.
Absolutely. The first year is when you basically get done what you're going to do in your presidency, because once you get beyond the first year, then members of Congress are thinking about themselves. They're thinking about the midterm election. And then, of course, you're thinking about the presidential election at year four. And then year six tends to be pretty bad for presidents. And so the members of Congress are thinking about themselves then. You're a lame duck in a second term. So a president really has that one year where they get things done or they don't. That's the year that Clinton got NAFTA passed, the year that George W. Bush got a big economic package. Then if you think about Obama, the health care bill comes out. It was actually passed in March of the second year, but the reality is that most of the heavy lifting was done in the first year. And so when a president has one year, they have to get off to a good start. And I think that was one of the real challenges that the Trump team faced from the very opening moments of the Trump presidency. They didn't have a particularly large number of people in place or ready to go. There's still a lot of vacancies in a lot of these government agencies. They have secretaries of these cabinet level jobs, but deputies and assistants, there's still a lot of vacancies there. And that makes it really hard for you to do things. Plus, I'm not sure that the Trump team thought they were going to win, so they didn't have an aggressive policy agenda ready to go in the way that a lot of presidential candidates do. It's one of the challenges, I think, of being a newbie is staffing up. It's an impossible job if you're experienced. It's even more impossible if this is your first government gig.
And now, and plus you've got kind of the cloud over everything is the special prosecutor.
Well, that's just it. I mean, how hard it is, I should think, for the Trump team to concentrate on doing whatever it is they want to do in terms of policy, because anybody working for Trump has to worry that they're next on the list of people being investigated. Yeah. They may be deposed. They may be answering questions. They may need to hire a lawyer. I mean, make no mistake about it. This can really, really undermine your ability to concentrate on things over the course of the day. And it's really very expensive. I mean, if you talk about some of these aides, they're building up hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal expenses, even if all they did was nothing. Just having to defend and answer questions, you cannot go into these meetings without high-quality legal representation, even if you didn't do anything wrong yourself.
And we've never really seen something like this of where – that special prosecutor took over and started real early in the Trump presidency. It's not like with President Nixon and you're in the second term.
Right. I mean, the Watergate situation happened during the Nixon reelection in 1972.
Yeah.
The break-in was in June of 72. So he'd already been president for 4 years at that point. But this was something that started even before the election, we know now. Now, in the weeks before the election, when the FBI director James Comey said that Hillary Clinton was under investigation, then she wasn't, then she was back under investigation. It turns out there was also an investigation going on with Trump and the Trump campaign in collusion. This was occurring before the election. But Comey only told the country about the Clinton investigation, not the investigation into Trump. And that may have had a particularly significant impact in the election. But that being said, the real challenge for the Trump presidency going forward is this question of how the Russians may or may not have infiltrated into the political system and how that what impact that might have had on the election. I mean, make no mistake about it. I mean, for people of a certain age, you know, the idea that Russians are benign influences in American politics is just simply laughable. And the idea that they can do this and that the real question is not whether they did it and how to prevent it from happening again, but rather the question of Trump being absolutely denying all kinds of things despite the mounting evidence of Russian intervention or not. Now, I'm not saying that Trump was in the middle of these things. We don't know. The special prosecutor will tell us. But what is very clear is this country was attacked, at least attempted, undermining of our political system through social media bots, through efforts to check with the election systems in various states, through all of the ways in which Russian we already know have engaged in our electoral system. We need to be more protective of that. The American system should be much more insulated against foreign involvement. There shouldn't be any foreign money. There shouldn't be any foreign engagement. And the idea that what the Russians did in 2016 could happen again in 2018 or 2020 should be very problematic, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. But we're not really focusing on that. We're focusing on a whole bunch of other things with respect to this question of whether there are like personal emails with lovers at the FBI and all kinds of ridiculous things. No, no, no. This is a national security question, perhaps one of the biggest ones, and we're not paying attention to it. That's my personal view on this point.
I was going to ask you that because that does seem that you look at this and you think with both political parties that this is this you don't want to have this repeated again.
Well, that's just it. And just because the Russians were pro-Republican in the last election cycle is no assurance that they will be pro-Republican in the next. Mm-hmm. And so you have to think, even if you're a Republican, that this idea of having Russian infiltration into the election is a problem because what has been done to others can be done to you. The Russians can be very, very secular in the point of looking out for their own interests. And there are plenty of people on the left who are pro-Russian in one way or another, as well as people on the right. So it isn't necessarily any sort of assurance that Russians will always assist the Republicans. And the Republicans should be more concerned about the country than their own political fortunes in terms of how the Republicans might be assisted by the Russians.
Well, this is going to be an interesting year in a number of ways, and I don't know when the investigation, how long, because that doesn't seem like it's even close to wrapping up.
Oh, we're talking about several more months. I mean, when these investigations happen, we don't know what's going on. We only hear like pieces of the story. We know, for example, that Sessions was interviewed last week. We know for a fact that the FBI director was interviewed recently, the former FBI director, James Comey. We know that that the investigation wants to ask questions of Trump, particularly relating to the issues with respect to General Flynn and the Russian engagement that he had with – and he's pled guilty, of course. And then, of course, the issues with respect to Manafort and the meetings with Trump Jr. and others with Russians during the campaign, the issues of firing Comey. There's a whole long laundry list of things that that Trump himself is going to be asked by the investigator if that investigation takes place. I'm guessing we're still several months away from any kind of resolution. But we also don't know who else is meeting with them. There may be other guilty pleas. There may be other people cooperating. Because one of the problems you have when you're a president and you are in a situation like Trump is in right now, it's everybody for themselves. And there aren't enough lifeboats for everybody. And so there are a lot of people who are asking themselves, do I want to go to jail for a president? Do I want to cooperate with a prosecutor? The answer that most of them will say is they don't want to go to jail for somebody else. And that means that they will cooperate in ways to protect themselves. And that's not necessarily going to be useful for the administration because this is going to go on and on and on. This is a very extensive investigation. It's pretty open-ended in terms of the way that the laws are set up in terms of budget. So it isn't like they run out of money.
Well, and we've seen everyone for themselves. We've seen that with Steve Bannon and that whole thing, and with the book that came out.
Absolutely, and Steve Bannon, like General Flynn or Paul Manafort, these were a relatively small number of people. I mean, the thing to remember about the Trump campaign, and which has made it so different from so many other campaigns, Republican and Democratic campaigns, is that it was run by this tiny cadre of people. There were really only five or six people in the room for a lot of these big meetings. And those kinds of decisions only involve a few witnesses. And in that room, Manafort. In that room, Bannon. In that room, Flynn. And so you've got an awful lot of people who were very close to the top, who were in all the key meetings, who are now having conversations. And this is one of the painful realities that the Trump administration has to face. We don't know, again, whether laws were broken yet or anything like that. I always want to emphasize these things. Yeah. Nobody at the top level has been charged. But you've got people pretty high up like Flynn that have already pled guilty and are cooperating. And when I read the plea agreement, it might be very troubling to imagine how much cooperation that Flynn has provided to the prosecutor and how long it might have been going on.
Stephen Farnsworth is a professor of political science and international affairs and the director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at the University of Mary Washington. More coming up on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Got an opinion about today's show? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth from the University of Mary Washington here this morning as we talk politics. Dr. Farnsworth, you look at this and President Trump is not your typical Republican in any way, it seems, is I guess the one thing everybody can agree on.
Well, I mean, think about how different things would have been if this president were John McCain or Mitt Romney rather than Donald Trump, or if it were Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are Republicans who have some political experience. But they also, I would argue, have more effective judgment than Donald Trump in terms of what to do and what not to do. I think that Donald Trump, his single biggest challenge when he became president is – appreciating that he's not a CEO anymore. You know, when you run a family business, your way or the highway is how it is.
Yeah.
There is nothing that you get by way of shared power or any questions of accountability. If it's your family business, it's your way. And when you're president, that's not how it is. You're not a national CEO. You have to work with Congress. You have to appreciate the niceties of the law. And you just simply can't do whatever you please. And I think that that has been the significant challenge that Trump has faced. And I'm not sure that even now he gets it. He says what's on his mind, and that may endear him in terms of people who, you know, he's very effective at speaking to the anger in the country. But that's not how you stay within the letter of the law. I think that the Donald Trump campaign is in a lot of trouble right now in terms of the way that it dealt with the Russians and perhaps the Trump presidency as well because of the unwillingness to take very seriously the concerns of lawyers, the traditions of keeping international forces at bay during a political campaign. I mean, there have been issues in American in the past where other countries have tried to influence elections in previous election mm-hmm. cycles, and other campaigns, Republicans and Democrats, did not cooperate. In fact, in some cases, when they were getting assistance from international powers, they simply turned it over to the FBI. And so you had a very strong departure from the way that people have governed in the past. I feel like the Trump presidency is kind of like an impulsive presidency. You think about sort of this immediate reaction in terms of what someone says and how you respond. You know, they're not necessarily thinking things through down the highway. It's sort of like driving down the road looking through the hood ornament. You know, you don't appreciate the magnitude of all the things that are also related.
Yeah.
If you think about trade, for example, you know, people in the industrial Midwest, they're very concerned about factories and jobs, and that's certainly a genuine concern. If you think about like what the world was like in Buffalo or Youngstown or Cleveland 30 years ago and what it's like now, you say, wait a minute, I want to go back. But if you're thinking about the farmers in the Midwest and they want to export their products, you know, they don't want a trade war. So, you know, remember, what you do to others can be done to you. And so things like getting rid of Obamacare or getting rid of trade pacts. I mean, these are very complicated issues, and they don't lend themselves to that simple rip it out, root and branch solution that you sometimes hear. And a more experienced politician would know that. And a more experienced politician would know that what you have to do is actually cooperate with people. I mean, when you insult members of Congress, when you talk about little Marco, and you talk about Flake the loser, and you talk about all these various insults. You know, one of the first rules of politics is if you want people to do things for you, insulting them is probably not the way to get that outcome. But it's okay when you're a family business and you're a CEO. Mm-hmm. You can belittle workers as much as you want, and as long as they're willing to take it and they stay working for you, it's no big deal. But what goes around comes around, and that's the potential problem. I mean, you could imagine Chuck Schumer and Donald Trump making a deal on infrastructure, but not when they're insulting each other, not when they're going into this ugliness. And you have a system in which you have to appreciate that being president doesn't mean you're a CEO. And even now, I'm not sure that Donald Trump gets that.
As we – I guess the next kind of milepost to see how – where we're at will be the elections, the congressional elections this fall.
Well, that's a key thing. I mean, we don't know, of course, what the world is going to look like in November. But right now, you look at the special elections that have taken place. You look at the House of Delegates elections in Virginia, the governor's race, the huge margin there compared to the norm in Virginia. I mean, there's a lot of troubling signs for the Republican Party. I mean, Donald Trump's approval is consistently 40% or lower in all the polls. There are a growing number of people who are not reflexively Donald Trump voters who don't like what they see. If you look at swing voters, independent voters, you see a really questioning approach to Donald Trump. Now, like I say, things can change. I mean, will the economy continue to crank out at about 3% GDP? Will Donald Trump start to get more credit for that? You know, that those kinds of things. I mean, if you continue to see the economic growth that you're seeing now, it may be a better November for Republicans than it is right now, than it looks like it's going to be right now. If you think about the investigation, I mean, it's if the investigation shows that all the problems were the problems of underlings, that Donald Trump himself wasn't part of meetings, didn't dictate these kinds of decisions about collusions with the Russians and possible cover-up with respect to these things. If Donald Trump gets some sort of clear bill of help from the FBI, that could help the Republicans. I mean, you don't really know because so much can change so quickly in politics. But right now, if you look at the elections of 2017, the special election in Alabama, the special elections in various congressional districts, Democrats are pretty consistently overperforming by about 20 percentage points. And that's a big difference. I mean, if you are talking about a district that Donald Trump won 60-40 and it's now 50-50, you know, or better for the Democrats, that's going to mean an awful lot of Republicans in trouble in 2018. And sophisticated political operatives that they are, you see that when you think about all the Republicans around the country who are not running for reelection this cycle. A lot of people in the House, if you think about people in suburban areas in particular, suburban congressional districts in California, upstate New York, New Jersey, wherever we look at the kinds of voter districts that are swing districts, there are a lot of Republicans who think, you know what, I'm not going to run for another term. And that's a sure sign that they're reading the tea leaves and they don't think that their prospects are particularly good in the middle of the Donald Trump presidency. That's a very bad sign for Republicans because incumbents have huge advantages in terms of fundraising and name recognition and everything else. If it's an open seat, as we discovered in the House District 28, it changes a great deal. Even though one party is favored, changing the names really can change the outcome.
Yeah, because no one saw that coming at all, that Speaker Howell's seat would be suddenly be vulnerable.
Well, as long as Speaker Howell was running, it wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, he was a long-time, 30-year member of the House of Delegates. Everybody knew him around here. And he had a huge base of support in this community. But when you move to an open seat election, as we did in the Fredericksburg-Stafford District, District 28, you have a whole different dynamic. Even though the Republican who is now in the House of Delegates, Delegate Thomas, was known in parts of Stafford, he wasn't known in the city particularly, and he wasn't really didn't have the visibility that Speaker, statewide Speaker of the House of Delegates would have.
Yeah.
And so not that he was a bad candidate or anything like that. It just shows you how the politics can really differ when you change from an incumbent to an open seat election. And you couple that open seat dynamic with a compelling Democratic candidate, you couple it with a lot of hostility to Trump, and all of a sudden a safe Republican seat isn't so safe anymore. And if the Democrats can come this close in the 28th, you can see what can happen to them in other places. Look at all the Democratic gains in Prince William County. You look at a statewide election. Terry McAuliffe was elected governor by about 3 points. For Ralph Northam, it was more like 9. And that's a sign of how Virginia's changing. It's a sign of how Trump can really hurt a lot of Republicans. And that's, I think, one of the key things to think about as we're looking into the politics of 2018. Trump needs a win. He needs a big win about something that people care about. That economic bill that passed last time is of some use, but it's not going to really have that kind of impact, I don't think, in terms of folks in short attention span politics that really is going to match up, say, with an infrastructure bill. If there were one thing I would tell President Trump to do is work with the Democrats, get an infrastructure bill, get some people building stuff, because that's going to affect those working class communities, the industrial Midwest. There's steel jobs. There's work with respect to the construction of new highways. And those kind of infrastructure bills pay off all kinds of ways in terms of economic development, people deciding to put factories by highways that are better, or better airports or train stations, whatever it might be. You're talking about an environment that is more conducive to business. And that's where you see the real ramping up of economic activity, because if you don't have an infrastructure bill, I'm not sure that there's anything that's going to convince swing voters that the Trump campaign, the Trump presidency, encourages them to vote for Republicans. The one other point I'd make is that the Trump presidency has been successful from the point of view of religious conservatives in some ways. I mean, you have a lot of conservative judges that have come on online. The Supreme Court seat that Obama wanted to fill, but the Republican majority Senate never had a hearing on Judge Garland is now filled by Justice Gorsuch. And that's a victory for, say, a pro-life politician. But one of the things that comes with that is an extraordinary level of compromise. I mean, the evangelical Christian leaders are being asked, so how do you feel about a president who is apparently paying money, hush money, to porn stars, who is talking about grabbing women, who is engaged in a very unchristian approach to the way that he talks about certain countries around the world.
Right.
I mean, to the extent that religion is about a brotherhood of man, you really don't see much encouragement for that point of view from Donald Trump. And so over and over again, I think religious leaders are really having to bite their tongue if they find that they want to support Donald Trump, because he is making it very hard to argue that his behavior in his personal life and in terms of his public life corresponds to traditional Christian values of charity and humility and cooperation.
Well, when we started this conversation, we said it's been an interesting year, and it's put a lot of people in a lot of uncomfortable situations. So we continue to watch it and to be continued. Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here, professor of political science and international affairs, and the director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at the University of Mary Washington. We will continue along. He's got a book coming out. We're going to talk about that. We'll talk a little state politics, too, before we get to the book. When we come back on News Talk 1230 WFVA, it's 8:31.
Okay, listen. We got to talk about something.
Talk done right. News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can weigh in on today's Town Talk topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, your host, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here from the University of Mary Washington. Before we one more quick thing with state politics. Since the Democrats were so successful in the General Assembly races by just running candidates, and then and I think a lot of those candidates just the 28th district is the example of being surprised. And we're starting to see that. I guess there's going to be a primary in the first congressional district with Democrats. I guess the state congressional races this year will be quite lively.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm when I look at the first congressional district, which stretches from Prince William County down to Hampton Roads. It's a long, thin district. It's a very Republican district. Normally, the Democrats struggle to find even one person willing to be the sacrificial lamb in that district. But this election cycle, we're seeing a whole series of Democrats who are interested in doing this. And so there's actually the likelihood we're going to have a primary in that district. For the Democrats. Now, sometimes there's a primary for Republicans, but that's generally not what we see in this district.
Yeah.
The reality, though, is that the Republican Party has to deal with an electorate in Virginia that is changing pretty rapidly in a statewide environment. I mean, if you think about Ed Gillespie, this was somebody who was a very, very effective candidate when he ran against Mark Warner in 2014. He almost was elected to the Senate. And this is somebody who understands policy. Somebody who had a whole series of policy details. I mean, we're talking about really the sort of anti-Trump message within the Republicans, not so much ideologically, but in terms of experience, competence, the focus on issues. He was a policy wonk, and that, you know, professionalism is often, I think, well received by voters who want somebody who's up to the job as often as not. And so, you know, the fact that that Ed Gillespie lost by such a large margin in Virginia, I think, speaks to the extent to which Donald Trump is a real challenge for Republicans to overcome. And that is a shame. I mean, you know, if you think about Republicans who would have been very effective at their jobs because they were experienced, they didn't necessarily win the elections. And if there's one thing that I've consistently seen is kind of problematic in American politics is that the skills and talents that get you elected are not the same skills and talents that make you good at the job. I mean, if Mitt Romney had been president, he would strike me as a very competent fellow. I think that would have been a presidency that would have been successful. If John McCain had been president, again, somebody who's experienced, understands the issues, I think that would have been very successful. If Ed Gillespie had been elected governor, again, same idea that you're talking about somebody who was up to the job. And I think that this is one of the things that is particularly problematic for those kind of workhorses in the Republican Party who know policy issues, who have a vision of what's going on. Donald Trump is making it hard for them to win. Now, I don't know that means that the incumbent in the first district, Congressman Whitman, is any real political trouble. But certainly if you think about, say, the 10th district out around Dulles and Winchester, that area, Barbara Comstock has a problem. If you're thinking about the second district in Hampton Roads, Scott Taylor, he's going to have potentially a significant challenge because not of what he's doing or what he isn't doing, but because this wave that we see in 2017 may be a wave that reappears in 2018, causing problems for even experienced, competent Republicans.
And I know General Assembly Republicans will tell you privately that statewide they're at a loss right now to try because of some of the things you just talked about of what it's going to take to win. One of them told me anything short of just the incumbent doing something, you know, making some huge gaffe, they right now are searching. What's it going to take now to win in Virginia, and especially Northern Virginia?
Well, I think it's clear that the Republican Party in Virginia has to retool. You know, when you think about that 9-point gap, I mean, a lot of that had to do with a hostility to Trump in the electorate. I think that's probably why it was 9 instead of 3. But it's not clear to me that without Trump, that Gillespie would necessarily have won anyway, because Virginia is getting more and more diverse. And if you think about where the votes are, your map of Virginia is very different than the traditional map because acres don't vote. You know, some of these counties are pretty big, but they may not have a lot of people in them. And so when you think about how you win an election in Virginia, if you're a Republican, here's what you do. You win in the suburbs. And people in the suburbs, I think, are more effectively reached by an economic message as opposed to a social conservative message. You know, the hostility to gays is not going to get you very far in Prince William County, in Henrico. When you think about where you have to do well as a Republican, you need to win in a significant number of suburban places to be competitive. Because what's happening now is that even the traditionally Republican areas like Chesterfield or Virginia Beach, those are big jurisdictions with lots of Republican votes in them. The Democrats are competing to a draw, sometimes even winning in these jurisdictions now. And if Republicans can't win in those big Republican counties anymore, they're not going to be winning statewide. And that's why I think the Republican Party really does need to retool. I think in particular, this policy on immigration is a significant problem. I think that a lot of Latino voters could be persuaded by the issues of small government conservatism that Republicans have. Many folks who come to America as immigrants, they might start their own businesses. And so they would be very, very sensitive to a lot of the small business issues that Republicans often bring to the table. But if they're going to say everybody out, they're not going to get those votes. Because even though obviously illegals are not voting, you are talking about illegals who might be cousins or brothers or neighbors of Latinos who are citizens and are voting. And so – and it's not clear to me that in one's daily life that people who are like making nasty remarks in the grocery stores or in schools or wherever are going to make a distinction. They're going to see what you look like and they're going to insult you or not depending on their point of view. But that kind of hostility that you see in your daily life if you don't look like a conventional suburban resident is going to be a problem. And that's going to be a big challenge for Republicans, because if you are not open to a changing demographic in America, you are not winning an election.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth is here from the University of Mary Washington. You have a number of books out, and this spring we'll have another one.
That's right. I've got a book that is – right now we're still going through the copy edits and the page proofs and things like that. But probably by – before graduation, book number 6 will be out. It's Presidential Communication and Character, from Clinton and Cable to Trump and Twitter. And so what I look at is the idea that the way the media cover the presidency has focused increasingly on questions of who they are as people in terms of character issues, not on their policy issues, but rather their personality issues. And that has been a steady movement across the last 20 years. And if we look at each president, we can see that as the media environment has changed, they have adapted to it. But one of the things that the presidents themselves are also doing is emphasizing character. And so you think about Clinton on talk TV. He was really good, I think, at the Phil Donahue cable kind of shows.
Yeah.
That was where he was able to make himself a likable person who, quote, understood our pain. You know, and then with George W. Bush, this was during the rise of Fox News. And Fox News and George W. Bush, I think, worked out very well together in terms of promoting who Bush was as a person. You know, the dynamic of Bush was this idea that he was a tough guy in a difficult environment, that he was really somebody who would stand up for American interests and had a personal level of morality that would be a nice contrast from the at the time, it seemed like a pretty offensive behavior from Bill Clinton. But I'm not sure what the standards are in the age of Trump for how we evaluate Bill Clinton now on personal matters. But then after that, you have Obama. And Obama's real skill was social media. I think that he was very, very good, particularly with respect to the issues like the comedy shows and the late night TV. He could slow jam the news. He could shoot basketball with BuzzFeed reporters. He could talk to the celebrities on YouTube, the people who were viral personalities.
Yeah.
He was good at all of that kind of stuff, memes and all the rest. And, of course, Trump, master of Twitter. But all of these environments, I think the presidents were good at the sort of dominant media culture of their presidencies. But all of these presidents increasingly talked about who they were as people and the theory being that if you like them as people, you might like their policies. And with Donald Trump, it's more of the same. His idea is that he wants to make America great again, which is a great slogan for Twitter. It's very simple. It's very direct. Mm-hmm. And it can allow you to say a lot of different things in terms of what matters. And if you look at the media today, I see reporters basically like six-year-olds chasing soccer balls. You know, they're all around. Yep. There's no play. They're all following the ball.
Yeah.
And the ball is whatever Donald Trump tweeted that morning. He says something before 7 a.m., and that's the news agenda for the day, for the whole country, in fact, the whole world.
Yeah.
And so if you look at what's in the Washington Post or what's in the Washington Times or what's in the Wall Street Journal, what's on the radio, everywhere you look, it is what Donald Trump said today on Twitter and what other people think about what he said. And that is a powerful presidential power. But it is also, I think, a system that really gets us to the point that we're always very disappointed in our presidents. Because if there's one thing we know about the American presidency, and this is what the founders intended, it was not designed to be all that powerful in office. It was designed to operate in collaboration with Congress. It was designed to be limited by the courts. It was a system of limited power. And that's why I really think that Donald Trump struggles, because he doesn't get that there's a court system that is as legitimate as he is, that there's a Congress that's as legitimate as he is. And you have to work with these people if you're going to get something done. It's the total opposite of a family business. And the unwillingness to really engage with that kind of give and take that's a problem for Trump getting what he wants. And if you don't get what you want, it's going to be real hard to run for re-election. And if you don't rebuild your brand, if you're at 40% approval, you're not helping your other Republicans.
Yeah. What an interesting topic, though, to look at, because you think of in just how presidential communication – because you go all the way – you think of how FDR used radio.
Right. I mean, one of the things to remember is that the first person who has the technology as president isn't necessarily the one who's good at it.
Yeah.
I mean, we all think of FDR on the radio. The presidents before FDR were on the radio too. Coolidge was on the radio. Yeah. Hoover was on the radio. Even Harding was on the radio. But none of them were as good at it as FDR. There was television in the 50s, but Eisenhower wasn't good on television.
John F. Kennedy was.
And then, of course, the rise of cable corresponds to Ronald Reagan. I mean, there was cable when Jimmy Carter was around, but he didn't make much use of it. Jimmy Carter then gives way to Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was good at it. And, you know, the internet had been around for a while. I mean, Fox News existed before George W. Bush, but he was the Republican who really made the most use of it. And that kind of dynamic is out there. I don't know that President Obama was particularly good at Twitter. I think that his real skill set was much more with, you know, YouTube celebrities, Between Two Ferns and things like that. But with Trump, it's Twitter. And that, you know, is a great vehicle if your message is not policy dense. If your message is just the soundbite of what you want. And what's I think so frustrating for a lot of Americans about every president is they think that each president represents some huge new day. You know, remember the excitement among the Democrats when Barack Obama was first elected in 2008. I mean, people had tears on their face in Chicago. And when Trump was elected last November 2016, same thing. You know, there were people who said, okay, now America's going to get its act together. You know, we're going to have a country that looks out for people like us. And, you know, those people in 2008 didn't get as much as they wanted. The people who were so excited in 2016, they didn't get as much as they wanted. And that's how the system works. But we don't seem to get the message. We have this period of euphoria followed by disappointment. It doesn't matter who the president is. They will disappoint. It's the nature of our political system. But it's a system that is not designed to be efficient. And that can be a real problem for people who don't want to negotiate with others as equals.
I have a copy of U.S. News and World Report when Jimmy Carter became president, and it's the headline on the cover says Jimmy Carter takes over. It's his family. They're walking down Pennsylvania Avenue after the inauguration, all hand in hand, and everybody was – it was a sunny day, and he was a one-term president. So you're right.
Yeah. Well, people have a good day. It's called Inauguration Day. And then the trouble starts.
It's Dr. Stephen Farnsworth from the University of Mary Washington here. Again, the book is called Presidential Communication.
And Character.
And Character.
From Clinton and Cable to Twitter and Trump.
That's just what a great just the alliteration there worked out just perfectly. We're going to wrap this up when we come back on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Got an opinion about today's show? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here, professor of political science and international affairs and the director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at the University of Mary Washington. The last part of that title there, the center has been going gangbusters. You do surveys. You've got students that are involved in all areas of state and national politics.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I'm really very grateful about being in the Fredericksburg area, because a lot of the elected officials around here are really very helpful. They'll come to my classes. They'll meet with my students. It's just great. But they also are willing to take students on for internships. I mean, we've had interns with Senator Kaine, Congressman Whitman, our local delegation in Richmond. You are really looking at an environment where people around here are very good at giving Mary Washington students opportunities. And one of the good things, of course, about the Mary Washington students is that they tend to be pretty good. And so they're able to contribute, too, in terms of causes that they care about and issues that they care about. And Democratic and Republican, both the elected officials have been really good. And it's been an opportunity for students who are majoring in political science and really interested in elections or issues that that concern them to get a sort of a leg up, whether it's, you know, they're focused on pro-life issues or autism or political candidate that they like. We had a number of people working for Gillespie, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, they found a home, and that's one of the nice things. And then they become they get a job on the Hill or in Richmond or whatever, and then they look out for the next generation of Mary Washington students. And so what the center does is bring some of those people together. You know, we can get recent graduates looking out for the next generation of students, and that's a great opportunity. We also do polling that gives us a sense of where the pulse of Virginia is, because I think that one of the things that we see in Virginia is a state that is changing a great deal. More and more people moving into Virginia from other states, that really changes the complexion, the color of the state in terms of its politics, whether you're looking at traditional Virginia. I mean, the idea that we would have a debate in Virginia about whether or not to show the Confederate flag or how we would keep statues and or remove them in Civil War monuments around the state. I mean, you know, if you had asked me, I've been in Virginia 20 years. I thought, what? This is not happening. But look at how fast Virginia is changing. And, you know, and now there are individual communities that are really, really rethinking how these traditional things have been done. And that, I think, speaks to the very rapid changing nature of Virginia politics. And that's one of the things that we can do with our surveys is look at those kinds of dynamics, because Virginia is not a static state by any means. I mean, with all the military, with all the government workers, with all the contractors, Virginia is going to be a state that's going to be very fluid. Historically, is going to be changing a great deal, as it has over the last few decades. Expect more of that going forward.
Well, and Dr. Farnsworth, your students, as opposed to you go to some of the bigger universities that might have the name, but where we are and the connections that you have and the connections that you've made, you go to Mary Washington and get involved with political science, and like you say, you're gonna be in the front row on a lot of these debates.
Well, you know, my undergraduate degree was from Dartmouth, and so I went to college in New Hampshire. And if I wanted to spend a semester in Washington, I would have had to take a semester off and gone on a 4.5-year program and gone to the long-term idea of paying extra tuition and all the rest. Mary Washington students, if they want to do an internship in Washington or Richmond, they can stack their classes on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and take the VRE up to D.C. twice a week and get that work experience, still graduate on time, still sleep in their dorm room at night, still be there with all their friends and all their community activities on campus. Or they could get on the road and go down to 95 and to Richmond and have that experience.
We are out of time. Dr. Stephen Farnsworth at UMW. That's it for Town Talk. See you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. The Glenn Beck program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.